The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Wednesday, everyone, and a busy day at that. I need to start off by thanking you for bearing with us yesterday. Gotta Laugh and I just had one of those days, you know. And, you know, the way she got her screen name, Gotta Laugh, is because you gotta laugh. Because the alternative is not laughing. And laughing is important. It's something we all need for our mental health. And yesterday was just one of those days. Honestly, it wasn't planned that way, but it turned into kind of a laugh fest. So thanks for everyone who hung with us and got the joke and appreciated it. I did hear from a number of you today who enjoyed it. So I'm really glad about that. Today, we are going to be decidedly more serious, although I do have a couple of things that you can scoff at before we get to Ari Berman, who will join us for the second half hour of the program. Ari Berman is these days writing for Mother Jones Magazine, but he's been, you know, I've been talking to Ari Berman for as long as I've been doing this, doing the talk radio, political stuff. And for as long as I've known him, he has been covering the voting rights beat. I don't know that he set out to do that. I think it just became his mission, kind of, sort of. He wrote a book, it's got to be 5 years ago already, called Give Us the Ballot. That is still topical. It's still important, although things have changed. The characters have changed. The precarious nature of our situation remains the same. And I'm glad he's on the beat. So I think when I first met him, maybe he was writing for Think Progress. I'm not sure. I know then he was writing for The Nation. He's been at Mother Jones now for a few years. And sadly, there's nothing, you know, there's it doesn't look like it's easing up anytime soon. We're going to get to voting rights and a few other issues I have surrounding it closer to the bottom of the hour when Ari Berman comes on. But before we get there, I think I have to start today with Merrick Garland. What the actual fuck, Merrick Garland? You know, yesterday in What's News, I started in on this because I read the night before that Merrick Garland's Department of Justice will defend Donald Trump in that defamation suit brought by the writer E. Jean Carroll. Now, I know you remember the outrage we all felt when Bill Barr announced that they were taking that case from a state court and moving it to federal court under the Justice Department, that they were going to defend it. And we all screamed. It was a collective scream saying, wait a minute, the Justice Department is not the president's personal law firm. The attorney general is not the president's personal attorney. He's our attorney. We, the citizens of the United States of America. Now, not that I would want Bill Barr or Jeff Sessions or who's the third guy he brought in, Jeffrey Rosen or somebody like that. Not that I would want any of them as my attorney. But I thought once the Democrats got back in control, that sanity would return. However, Joe Biden thought he was being smart when he chose Merrick Garland to be the attorney general. You see, for those who don't remember, let me give you the Reader's Digest version here. When Barack Obama had, Antonin Scalia died, Barack Obama still had, I think, 11 months left in his term. I don't have the dates in front of me, so I'm, you know, it's in that neighborhood, around a year left in his term. And Barack Obama, who always wanted everyone to love him and thought he was doing the right thing by making, you know, extending olive branches to the Republicans, did it in that instance. Now, Mitch McConnell, we knew, was going to hold up whoever Obama put forward. But Obama still put forward a guy who is a conservative. Merrick Garland is not the justice you would think of when you say, oh, the democratically elected president from the Democratic Party has a rare opening on the Supreme Court. He should have picked a younger, you know, 40-ish civil rights attorney, somebody who would be on the side of the people. But instead, he's like, I'm going to be the president for all the people. And he picked out this guy who Republicans had suggested would be a great choice. Easy to confirm because he's one of them. But Mitch McConnell, being who Mitch McConnell is, said, hell no, I'm not going to give you jack shit. I'm paraphrasing a little bit here in case you were wondering. I don't know if he actually used those words, although I can imagine it. And for a year, Mitch McConnell held that Supreme Court seat open to the point where he didn't even allow interviews. He didn't allow his Republican Senate members to hold meetings with the Supreme Court nominee, which is standard operating procedure. They go around the Senate and they meet with the senators to answer questions. That didn't even happen. Not one hearing was held because Mitch McConnell is an obstructionist. Because Mitch McConnell, as he dubbed himself, the Grim Reaper of the Senate, I think he used those words, it's where bills go to die because Mitch McConnell wants nothing, if there's a Democrat in office in the presidency. And he said it back when Obama was in office.
My one goal is to make Obama a one-term president.
And when that didn't work, his goal was to not let anything go through and certainly not let that president name another justice to the Supreme Court, even though Scalia died when Obama still had about a year to go. And Obama, and I do fault him for this, sat there and took it. Don't ask me what he could have done, but he could have done something. Can you imagine George W. Bush, or for that matter, Donald Orange Man Trump, sitting back while the Democrats, who at the time ran the Senate, kept them from putting up a Supreme Court justice when a seat came open on their watch? I promise you it wouldn't have happened because no matter what, the Republicans have balls. And that's something that I guess Democrats lack. All right. I may regret this. We've got a call coming in from the 434 area code. We'll see. Hi, who's this?
This is your best friend, Linwood, speaking. How are you doing?
Oh,
today?
It's Linwood. Hey, Linwood, just don't make any racist remarks, and I have no problem with you.
Oh, no. You took me out of context because I was actually...
No.
When I wanted to discuss that with you, it was about the actual book that I read that came out in 1984 by a Jewish person.
I don't care. But you came on my air, and you said the Zionists control the media. That got me to hit the red button to hang up on you. I don't care if you're quoting somebody. You don't say shit like that on my show.
Well, I apologize.
Okay.
I apologize.
No problem. So what's on your mind today, Linwood?
The Democratic Party has really plucked everyone's nerves here because what you see is a weak leadership in Chuck Schumer.
Yeah.
You see this sort of pacifist mentality of, like, Joe Manchin. Well, we have to get along and we have to make it work. Well, they're not trying to make it work.
That's right.
When they had Donald Trump in office, they made it clear bipartisanship is off the table.
That's right. So why are we all of a sudden held to a standard that they wouldn't even aspire to? They had no interest in anything the Democrats had to say or felt or thought was important. Nothing. I understand Joe Biden, you know, threw out that olive branch, but they're not interested in it. So fuck them. And I don't know why he's playing around with them. So on this infrastructure deal, yesterday he finally cut ties with Senator Capito, or whatever her name is, from West Virginia, who, Mitch McConnell only chose because of, she's the counterpart to Joe Manchin. And I don't know, he thought he was making a statement or something. Plus, she's not exactly a front bencher in the Republican Senate. You know, he knew she was going to fail, and he set her up to fail, and she did fail. So now that Biden said that's off, he's like, okay, so let's talk with other Republicans. Really, Joe? Come on, man.
See, this is going to start happening here.
Yeah.
If the Democrats, if the Senate is not functioning. And it's not just the Democrats. The Republicans, they want that bargaining chip. And this is why Sinema and Manchin are saying, oh, wait, whoa, here. If we give her this filibuster, we're going to get hammered if we end up in the minority. We could lose everything.
But the thing they won't realize is if they don't get rid of the filibuster, the Democrats will always be in the minority from here on out because they are upending every voting law that keeps them honest on the books. They're doing away with it all, and there's no way we can stop them unless we do away with the filibuster. So by Sinema and Manchin saying, ooh, we're going to protect democracy, they're breaking democracy.
It's not a democracy.
No.
The democracy is the majority of people who vote have the right to rule.
Yep.
Yeah, but Manchin and Sinema, I mean, let's just put Schumer in it as well. They're used to being in the minority. And this is a minority mentality.
Yeah.
Hey, we need to make sure that we have minority leverage from the tyranny of the majority.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you, Linwood.
You know, because, okay, let's just keep this 100 honest. With Barack Obama, that was a color issue. You know, he had to, it's like they were all non-white people. You have to play it safe with whitey. You have to play it safe with them. If you go out there and do one thing that makes white people uncomfortable and you're a non-white person, oh, we can't have that, you know, excuse my terms, we can't have that nigger in office again.
Yeah,
no, please don't use it.
You know what, Linwood, that's the second time you used that word on the show. If I can't say it, I'm not going to let you say it just because you happen to be black. It's not an okay word.
I'm sorry.
Let's not use that word.
I'm sorry, Nicole. It makes me angry.
I know.
It makes me so angry that the Democratic Party and many of its non-white members have been pacifists.
Right.
And that's really what it is. It's the pacifistivity to white rule, white supremacy ideology. It's
yep.
like, okay, look, if we have to play it safe, and I'm a non-white person. I've heard this all my life. You know, don't make white folks angry.
No.
You can't say stuff like that.
You can, though. That's the problem. Hey, Linwood, I'm going to run because I got another call coming in. But that's part of the problem. That's a big part of the problem. Thanks for calling, Linwood. The big part of the problem is, you know, be angry. Be who you are. If I can be angry, you can be angry. Part of the whole thing with Obama was he never wanted to, you know, he was afraid to be the angry black man. But if he was angry, then he should be angry. All right. 954, you're on the line. Hi, who's this?
Hey, Nicole, it's Jim. I've called you a couple times. I'm the
yeah.
one that lives in Virginia, but still
right.
has a Fort Lauderdale
gotcha.
Phone number.
Yes.
Listen, I just want to let everyone know I'm so tired of hearing, not you, but other radio shows, and especially corporate media, news shows, even CNN and MSNBC, dancing around Joe Manchin. Like, what could he possibly be thinking? What is he thinking about this whole bipartisan thing, and let's be nice to the Republicans. We need to let everyone know that Joe Manchin is taking money from Koch Industries.
Mm.
He is nothing but a Republican with a little D by his name.
Yeah.
And I called his office today, and everyone needs to call that phone number and flood it.
Yeah.
Of course, he's not answering this.
Right. They won't.
His voice is on the phone, you know, the voicemail, but...
And I'm not telling you to do this, but
if you
call, have a zip code from a West Virginia
yeah.
zip code on you, because they only
well,
care if you're
I,
in
I
there.
I'm honest. I said I used to live in Florida. I live in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
I don't live in West Virginia, but you.
Then you know what? They don't care.
And yet your policies represent me and
right.
everyone else in this country.
Well, it's true.
Okay.
Go ahead and call, but they don't care. Honestly, if you're not a constituent, some of them even have
yeah.
phone lines that won't take your call if you're out of an area
well,
code from out of state.
I wasn't that cut off. But,
yeah.
You know, I've got the number right here. If you want to repeat it 100
okay.
times,
go ahead.
Feel free.
What is it?
It's 202-224-3954.
3954.
I urge everyone to call that number and don't stop calling.
You got it, Jim. Thanks for
I'm
calling.
I'm going to call it five times tomorrow.
Go for it.
Say, you haven't called me back yet. Do it.
All right.
Okay.
Sounds good. Thanks,
Love
Jim.
You. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. One more call. Hi, David. Oh, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I called on Skype and Sinema's office wouldn't answer.
Really?
So I don't know that it's necessarily the area code. she's just a...
They just don't answer.
She's just an asshole. So here's the thing. I mentioned this to you earlier. We need to stop calling Manchin and Sinema moderate. They're not moderate. Moderates don't take hostages. Joe Manchin believes in the filibuster. Kyrsten Sinema believes in the filibuster. They were not elected to go to Washington and implement their beliefs. They were elected to go to Washington and represent their constituents. Mm-hmm. It is in their constituents' interest to be able to fucking vote.
That's right. What
Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema need to do is to stop jerking off their own goddamn ego and represent their constituents instead of their fucking beliefs. You mentioned the other day about Marcy Kaptur when you had Kucinich and how she went to the House of Representatives and stood up for her religious beliefs.
Yeah.
Fuck your religious beliefs.
That's right.
You're not there to implement those. You're there to represent your
goddamn constituents. The people who elected you. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, but you know that. All right, David. Thank you.
Love you, Madeline.
Love you, too. Bye. Yeah, that's Mr. I was going to say Mr. Sandler, but he's not because it's a thing because I didn't take his name. You know. Okay. Anyway, my husband. You see up if you're watching one of the videos, I had other stuff I was going to get to, but I took some phone calls. So we're jumping ahead in the program because we're going to stay on the subject of Joe Manchin. Joe fucking Manchin. By the way, remember a couple of years ago, the uproar when the price of the EpiPen went through the roof? It was like increased by 5,000% or something. That wasn't Martin Scorsese, the little weasel that's in prison. That was Joe Manchin's daughter. She runs the pharmaceutical company that manufactures EpiPens. And she is the one responsible for that. So it runs in the family, in case you were wondering. So as for why I have Leonard Pitt's photo up on the screen, it's because I'm going to read you something from him. I'm telling you, he's really the one thing that makes our subscription to the Miami Herald still worth it. Because Carl Hyson doesn't write for them anymore. And Dave Barry rarely does. But Leonard Pitt's still does. And in today's paper, I think he writes two columns a week, and he's great. And I want to share with you what Leonard Pitt wrote that's in today's Miami Herald. And goes like this. It's an open letter. It says, Dear Senator Joe Manchin, it has only been 56 years. As Americans, we are pleased to call ourselves one of the world's oldest democracies. We're actually one of the world's newest. Democracy, after all, is government shaped by the will of the people. But until 1920, roughly half the people were not allowed to vote, disqualified by dint of gender. And until 1965, 56 years ago, roughly 10% were restricted by color of skin. So American democracy is not even as old as you are. Its newness, its recentness, is invoked here to help you understand the trepidation with which some of us regard the dozens of bills being pondered and passed in Republican-led state houses across the country with the intention and certain effect of keeping us from voting. As part of a demographic whose access to that right has never been impeded, perhaps you find it difficult to appreciate the profound distress the profound distress and sense of historical deja vu some of us are now processing. To say nothing of our equally profound disappointment in those who could defend us choosing to let let us down, failing to meet the moment with the urgency it requires. Sadly, that's a category into which you fall. The right to vote is fundamental to our American democracy. You wrote that in a Sunday op-ed in the Charleston Gazette Mail of West Virginia. You then spent 1,000 words explaining why you will not protect this right by supporting the For the People Act, which would end partisan gerrymandering, punish those who try to intimidate voters, and streamline voter registration, among other urgently needed reforms. Your argument boils down to, I won't vote for the bill because it doesn't have bipartisan support. You lodge no other complaint against it. But your reasoning is nonsensical. Would you decline to support a For the Chickens Act solely because the foxes refused to sign on? Yes, you did signal a willingness to vote for a companion bill, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which would repair the Voting Rights Act that was gutted by the Supreme Court in 2013. But even here, your support is conditioned upon Republican buy-in. You have flatly ruled out ending or even carving out a one-time exemption from the filibuster, a parliamentary procedure that allows a minority party to block legislation that the majority approves. There has been much speculation on why you're doing this. Some say you enjoy the attention. Some say you're just not very smart. But the scariest idea is that you are sincere, that you truly believe this radical and unrequited commitment to bipartisanship is what's best. It's entirely possible, however, to be sincere and yet sincerely wrong. And you are. In effect, you ask those of us who face the loss of our voting rights to trust you as you wager those rights on Republican integrity and good faith. But as recent years have proven ad nauseum, those are qualities your colleagues have in vanishingly short supply. Moreover, if America is what America says, then my ballot is not yours to gamble with. Bipartisanship is very important, yes, but the right to vote is sacred, fundamental, to use your word. When you prioritize the former above the latter, you echo all the other times this country has made us the fulcrum of its moral compromises, deemed something else to be of more importance than our rights as human beings. Sir, the error you are making is seismic and potentially tragic. Reconsider, please. That is the op-ed written by Leonard Pitts. It's in today's Miami Herald. This is his home paper. He's syndicated nationally, so he may be in your newspaper. But yes, everybody needs to read that. I will post the text of that op-ed on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com/6-9-21, because that's how I post them. And that's what we're going to talk to Ari Berman about. But I'll tell you what, somebody has been very persistent on the phones from the 901 area code. Hi, who's this?
Hi, Nicole. This is Michael from Memphis. How you doing?
Hey, Michael. I'm okay. What's on your mind?
Well, I share Linwood because I'm an angry black man, because that's what you're considered anytime you have anything to say about wrong crap that's going on.
Right.
So I share his passion and his anger. And I get tired of Democrats. And you said about Barack Obama, and this is where I clash with a lot of black folks.
Yeah.
And I remember when people got so mad at Dr. Cornel West. They got so mad at Tavis Smiley.
They were speaking the truth.
Obama showed a lot of cowardice in his
job.
Yes,
he did. Yes, he did.
I'm not saying he was an awful president. I would never say that, because he did some things, but he had no balls.
He had no balls. He had no testicular fortitude.
By Merrick Garland.
Right.
He's a piece of shit.
Exactly. Yes.
And he was a piece of shit then, and people made all this big deal. I'm like, guys, you obviously hadn't looked at this guy's
That's
work.
That's right. No, they thought just because Obama nominated him that he's got to be great. He was not great then, and he's certainly not great now.
And people are angry because, and don't be surprised if this whole thing with January 6th, all that shit's going to be swept up. Nobody's going to get seriously charged. They're going to sacrifice a couple of guys, of course.
Right. Do you know what they're doing
now?
Me being black,
I'm hoping that black idiot that was up there, I'm hoping they give this punk-ass life. They shouldn't have your black ass up there. But they're going to sacrifice a few. They have to. But for the most part, they're going to get to walk.
Yeah, right. No, now they're making a big stink. They want to target the officer who shot Ashley Babbitt. Remember, when she was shot and killed, she was trying to break through the broken glass where there were many cops with guns on the other side and go through the glass into the chamber, into the House of Representatives. Sacred
treason.
Right. Exactly.
Because if I'm not mistaken, that is the penalty for treason in this country.
Yes. And they had every right to shoot her, but now her family is suing, I guess, the Biden administration to get the name of the cop who killed her. Sorry. She forfeited that right when she committed treason.
Right. But this country is headed... And it's the code words. And again, being a black person, when you hear woke is the new N-word.
Yeah.
Because you hear how it's used constantly. And when people say, I'm like, you really did? I don't understand what you're saying right now. Are you serious right now?
Right.
And it's constant. You hear it's on, it's a constant barrage. Tucker Carlson, all of these people.
Horrible.
But it's okay. It's normal. And Donald Trump made it okay.
Yeah.
And people discount this guy. Well, he's not president anymore. Really? You really think that's the case?
But, you know, never before in history has a defeated president gone on to rule the party that he lost. Not only lost the presidency, lost the Senate, and still, you know, lost the House during his tenure. He lost everything, and yet he still has is holding them hostage. Because
he appealed to white rage.
I guess.
You had a black guy. Well, a semi-black guy in the White House.
Yeah, right.
And yeah. Donald Trump existed because of the rage of the fact that he was there. It doesn't matter that, you know, Obama was good to Wall Street, but regular folks, eh.
Yeah,
but
I
that
hear
doesn't
you.
Matter.
No.
The fact is he shouldn't have been there.
I
so everything
agree.
He did, I'm going to undo. If anybody put, I'm going to get rid of. I mean, and that's what it was all about. And he appealed. It's the same. The Klan does the same thing that the Nation of Islam does.
Right.
Or black
but
folks.
Now, let me tell you, let me
don't have anything, you get somebody to blame for it.
Gotcha. Let me tell you a couple other things about Merrick Garland before we get back to the voting matter. Well, because I'm running out of time because I got to get Ari Berman on in a minute. But what we learned that the Merrick Garland Department of Justice will defend Trump in this defamation suit brought by E. Jean Carroll, which is just astounding, right? Oh, in fact, let me play this if I can find it real quick. Oh, we're going to be late. Let me play this anyway. Hey, I'm going to run so I can play this clip. Merrick Garland, thank you for calling. Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. Merrick Garland spoke. There was a hearing today in the Senate, and Patrick Leahy, who needs to go home, and I understand he's filing to run again. Patrick Leahy, stop. Go home. You'll hear why I say that in a moment when you hear this clip. Patrick Leahy here is questioning Merrick Garland about this very issue.
Now, Attorney General, in the past few weeks, your department has endorsed some highly controversial positions taken by the former president's Justice Department.
Yeah.
Many have expressed concerns about that. For example, the Trump DOJ removed from the state court to federal court a defamation charge.
Come on, this is why he needs to go home.
Allegation
spit it out,
Donald
Pat.
Trump by a woman. The release of the OLC memo on
E. Jean Carroll is her name.
Conclusions and so on. How is this coming about? Are these criticisms valid or?
Oh, come on.
What do you say about him?
What do you say about him?
Senator, I'm grateful for you asking me the question, and I know about the criticisms. Look, the job of the Justice Department in making decisions of law is not to back any administration, previous or present.
Okay.
Our job is to represent the American people.
Yeah.
And our job in doing so is to ensure adherence to the rule of law, which is the fundamental requirement of a democracy or a republic or
okay.
a representative democracy.
Yeah.
And the essence of the rule of law is what I said when I accepted the nomination for Attorney General. It is that like cases be treated alike, that there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, that there not be one rule for friends and another for foes.
Okay.
Now, it is not always easy to apply that rule. Sometimes it means that we have to make a decision about the law that we would never have made and that we strongly disagree with as a matter of policy.
Bullshit.
I'm but calling bullshit. Case, okay. You know what? Because I'm running on time. Because that's bullshit. And okay, here's what he's doing. True, you have to hold up the law, and sometimes it might be things you don't necessarily agree with. Representing a president who, while he was in office, smeared a citizen, defamed her, that is not in the course of his duties as president. Therefore, the Justice Department has nothing to do with it. For him to pick up that case is blatantly wrong, just egregiously wrong. Sorry, that was really loud. Then we learn that Merrick Garland continued Bill Barr's practice of getting phone records of journalists when he was conducting, allegedly, investigations into leaks. Merrick Garland continued to try to get and in some cases, I'm guessing, was successful in getting the phone records of journalists until Joe Biden said, no, we don't do that. We will not do that anymore, which just happened. Merrick Garland, that's not upholding the law. That's breaking the law. And now we learn, oh, this is the best part of all. In fact, I'm going to read it to you from my news thing because my notes are not even here. God, this makes me so mad. Can you tell? I'm shaking. According to the Washington Post, the Biden administration confirmed in a yesterday court filing that it will vigorously defend a religious exemption from federal civil rights law that permits religious schools to discriminate against LGBTQ students, even if those schools receive federal funding. The filing said that Education Department and Christian schools, quote, share the same ultimate objective, namely to uphold the religious exemption as it is currently applied.
Bullshit.
That is not the job of the Justice Department. That is not the job of the Education Department. The filing has shocked gay rights activists. A guy named Paul Carlos Southwick is the director of the Religious Exemption Accountability Project. He told the Washington Post, quote, the government is now aligning itself with anti-LGBTQ hate in order to vigorously defend an exemption that everyone knows causes severe harm to LGBTQ students using taxpayer money. He said the religious exemption leaves students at risk of conversion therapy and expulsion, as well as shame, fear, anxiety, and loneliness. This is simply unacceptable. And let me say, Merrick Garland must go. Joe Biden needs to fire his ass. Have I been clear? Okay. Sorry. I've been shaking over that story. Those three stories, unconscionable, unacceptable. Just unacceptable. And Joe Biden better fix this shit immediately. Okay. Now, I think it's time to bring in Ari Berman. Because, well, it's time. So let's do it. All right. Let's go. Here we go. Ari's there. Let's go. I'm always happy when Ari Berman is available to join us on the show. I know you've been busy lately. And unfortunately, in this case, that's not a good thing because what you specialize in is voting rights. And there has been an assault, like I was going to say, like we've never seen before. But actually, Ari Berman, you tell us that it's almost exactly what we saw before. And you write about it in the cover story of the current issue of Mother Jones magazine in a piece called Jim Crow Killed Voting Rights for Generations. Now the GOP is repeating history. You wouldn't think this would happen in 2021, but here we are.
Yeah, that's right, Nicole. There's a lot of eerie parallels between things that were happening back then and things that are happening right now. If you look at what happened at the end of Reconstruction, you had turnout among Black voters for the first time. You had Black officials elected for the first time. Mm-hmm. Then you had a vicious white backlash. And it started with things like violence and fraud and intimidation. But where Jim Crow really succeeded was through quote unquote legal means, through things like poll taxes and literacy tests. And when Southern states changed their constitution to disenfranchise Black voters. And I think a lot of that history is playing out today, where first you had turnout from new demographic groups in 2020, much higher turnout than in past elections. You had an attempt to try to overturn the election through extra legal means, trying to throw out votes, intimidation, false claims of fraud, leading to an insurrection. Then what they tried to do is institutionalize the insurrection mm-hmm. by changing the country's voting laws. And so there's a lot of similarities between what happened then and what are happening now. And of course, back then, they rhetorically said they wanted to disenfranchise Black voters, but the laws themselves never actually said that, in the same way that the laws themselves in Georgia or Florida or Texas don't say that they want to disenfranchise communities of color or Democratic-leaning voters. But obviously, that's going to be the biggest impact of these laws.
Right. We're seeing it play out. You know, I'm here in Florida. So watching, we had a flawless election, and it went the way the Republicans wanted it to go. But it didn't fit their narrative, I guess. And so the guy we have in Tallahassee now, who I affectionately refer to as Governor Death Sentence, decided to double down and make things take what's not broke and not fix it and break it further. So that, you know, I voted for years down here absentee. I get my ballot in the mail for every election. I fill it out. I send it back in, or we drop it off at the supervisor of elections office. They're making that more difficult. Can't do that anymore. I guess now I'm going to have to register each time I want an absentee ballot. But I'm not the person they really don't want to vote. I guess they noticed that the 2020 election, a lot of people of color, especially I guess in Georgia, came out and voted, and they didn't like the outcome, even though their elected officials, the Secretary of State, and even the governor admitted that their election wasn't fraught with problems. So again, they're taking something that's not broken and attempting to fix it, in air quotes.
Well, that's what's happening. And what's going on is that they are totally fine with these voting methods when they're used by white Republicans. Mm-hmm. In fact, voting methods like vote by mail were pioneered by Republicans in places like Georgia and Florida. And it's only when Democrats and communities of color start using them that suddenly there becomes a problem. So in Georgia, it's only when the black use of vote by mail increases and the white share of vote by mail decreases that they decide to make vote by mail more difficult. Same thing in Florida. It's only in Florida when 680,000 more Democrats use mail voting than Republicans that they decide to say, let's roll back mail voting. Let's get rid of mail ballot drop boxes. Let's stop automatically sending ballots to voters, those kind of things. And it's just very strange because, again, as you mentioned, Florida said they had the most secure election ever. DeSantis said it was a model for the rest of the country. And it was Republicans in Georgia that stood up and defended their election integrity. And it just goes to show you that even in states that went their way, even in states where they defended the process, defending and institutionalizing the big lie overrides every other concern, potentially even what's good for their own voters.
Right. And seeing what is possible when the people are empowered to vote, and you give them candidates they want to vote for, and even more so, some they want to vote against, that they will take advantage of that, their legal right to vote. So they're trying to tamp that down as much as possible. Thus, these new laws that first went through in Georgia, then I believe Florida, now Texas, and it's spreading around the country. More than 30 states are trying to enact these new voter suppression laws that in some instances, and these are the ones that freak me out the most at night when I'm trying to sleep, would allow a Republican legislature to come in and say, we're not certifying that election. We think there was fraud, even though there's no proof, but they can overturn the results of the election and put in their own slate of electors?
Yeah, it's not really quite that cut and dry, but okay. Basically what they're doing in a few different states is making it easier for them to control the election process. So in Georgia, what they did is they stripped the Secretary of State as chair and voting member of the state election board after he stood up to Trump. Right. And now the gerrymandered legislature can control a majority of members of the board. And then the state election board can take over up to four county election boards, which could mean, for example, that the state election board could take over election operations in Fulton County, Atlanta, one of the largest and most Democratic counties in the state. So that is potentially chilling. And then in Texas, what they did is they basically said that it would be easier for Republican candidates to petition the courts to actually overturn an election, both because the standard of proof of evidence would be lower, but also because what you had to show would be lower as well. That instead of showing that fraud actually tilted the election, you could just say, well, the number of illegal votes could have been larger than the margin of victory, which of course was what Trump argued falsely in 2020. So that to me is their backstop here, that if all the suppression efforts fail, they want to have some sort of built-in mechanism to allow them potentially to overturn or not to certify the elections. And I'm not sure they'll actually be able to get away with this, but clearly this is the plan they'd like to be able to pull off in 2022 and 2024.
Wow. It is chilling. And, you know, you think we've never seen anything like this before, but then I direct people to go to motherjones.com, read the cover story in the new issue, Jim Crow Killed Voting Rights for Generations. Now the GOP is repeating history. So Ari Berman, you start there in Georgia in 1868 with a man named Henry McNeil Turner, who you note was one of 33 new black state legislators elected that year in Georgia. It looked like things were moving in a multiracial legislative direction until the white people in Georgia said, no, we don't like it this way. I'm oversimplifying, obviously. But explain what happened then. And you draw the parallels between then and now.
Well, it's pretty remarkable. What happened was in 1867, Georgia rewrote its constitution to give emancipated slaves, black men, the right to vote. In 1868, the first black members of the legislature were elected. You had 33 black members of the legislature elected. However, that same constitution that gave them the right to vote evidently did not guarantee them the right to hold office. You'd think that if you had the right to vote, you had the right to hold office. Right. But the former Confederate leaders of Georgia did not interpret that way. And what happened was white members of the legislature, both Democrats and Republicans, joined together to expel the black members of the legislature just months after the state was readmitted to the Union and ratified the 14th Amendment. And that really had a chilling effect on Reconstruction. The idea that black members could be elected and expelled within a matter of months showed how easily Reconstruction could be undermined. And that really paved the way for the restoration of white supremacy across the South. And I tell a story in the piece about a guy who was elected many years later, a state senator named David Lucas.
Right, 1974.
He's the first black member of the legislature elected from his area, from Macon, Georgia, since Reconstruction. And he represents the same city that one of the black lawmakers in 1868 named Henry McNeil Turner represented. And he goes down to the Senate floor. He's 71 years old right now. He goes down to the Georgia Senate floor earlier this year, and he gives this impassioned speech saying that the rollback of voting rights is like the end of Reconstruction. And he tells the story of how federal troops were pulled out of the South. And as a result, he says folks got lynched. And that's when we got Jim Crow. And so this history is very personal. One of the things I've really realized in terms of talking to people who have lived through Jim Crow, this history is very personal for them. They remember what happened, to people that came before them. They remember what it was like to grow up in a segregated society. In Georgia, they felt this tremendous sense of exhilaration when the state not only went for Joe Biden and black voters actually had votes that counted, but the fact that the state elected the first black senator, the first Jewish senator. Yeah. That was akin to electing the first black members of the legislature in 1868. And you had the same kind of white backlash that followed it. And I mean, quite literally, I mean, Warnock and Ossoff were elected, and then the next day is the insurrection at the Capitol. And so there's a lot of eerie parallels in terms of progress and then violence and then attempts to try to take the vote away from new demographic groups and new constituencies.
Right. Well, the insurrection at the Capitol would have happened the next day, I would think, regardless. But I think this probably added more fuel to their fire because they were pissed. How could this possibly be? They were supposed to be Republicans, and it fed into Donald Trump's lies about the Georgia election being fixed when it wasn't. Now you had Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, who did the right thing during the campaign, and now he's trying to backtrack on that and say, wait a minute, I still believe in keeping people from voting who have the right to vote.
The fact is, he was always very conservative, and he was very much in favor of voter suppression when he ran for Secretary of State and when he took the job. He just did his job in 2020. And that entailed standing up to Trump, but that was just doing his job. So, I mean, I give him credit for doing his job, but also that's what he should have been doing.
That's right.
And so it wasn't like he suddenly converted. I have been a little surprised, however, that he has not been more critical of a bill that strips him of power.
Right.
I mean, a key part of the bill takes away his own power. And so to me, that would taint the entire bill. If someone took away my power, said, you can't be a journalist anymore, I wouldn't really care what all the other provisions were in the bill, because it was such a personal attack on me. I think it's one of those situations where this is what the Trump factor is, which is now he's facing a primary challenger from someone who is a Stop the Steal advocate.
Oh, God.
And basically Raffensperger, I think, has just been condemned. They just passed a resolution condemning him at the state Republican Party convention. And this is really chilling, because if it can happen to a guy like that, that is basically faithfully toe the party line, it could pretty much happen to anyone. And the question is, I mean, it happened to Liz Cheney. I mean, the question is, where does it end? And I think it ends with only supporting people who you believe will do everything they can to suppress votes. And if they don't win, are committed to actually overturning elections. And that's just a radical breaking of democratic norms that I absolutely don't think we can normalize.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I don't see how anybody can look at it any differently. So then the next question is, what can we do to stop this? And from my reading, you're the expert, but from my reading, what we need is SB1. The For the People Act. Now, we've got a senator named Joe Manchin of West Virginia who says he doesn't support SB1, but he would support the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Well, two questions for you here around that one. He still doesn't have 60 votes for the John Lewis portion, for the John Lewis bill. And even if it did, that still wouldn't be enough to stop these laws from overturning elections. Overturning the will of the people. Am I right?
Yes, you're right on both counts. I mean, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act is bipartisan in the sense that Lisa Murkowski supports it, but it's not bipartisan in the sense that it has 60 votes in the Senate. I think it's unrealistic to expect 10 Republican senators to support any voting rights legislation at a time when their party is so committed to voter suppression, and only 6 Republican senators supported a January 6th commission. So I don't think there's any universe in which voting rights legislation with any kind of teeth gets 10 Republican votes. And so then the question is, what is Joe Manchin going to do when his preferred bill fails? Is he actually willing to try to pass it? Or is this just a messaging thing for him, and he's willing to allow American democracy to be essentially undermined because of some obscure Senate rule that nobody outside of the Senate actually cares about? And it's pretty remarkable to hear him say that voting rights legislation needs to be bipartisan when the Republican Party at the state level is doing everything they can to freeze out Democrats and to make it harder for them to vote. They're not waiting to pass their voter suppression bills until Democrats sign on to them. I mean, the whole point is to prevent Democrats from winning elections. So there seems like a total asymmetry here in terms of how they're approaching the issue. And the way the John Lewis Voting Rights Act works is it would stop future laws from being passed in states that fall under the formula for preclearance. So,
which was the Section 5 that was overturned, right?
Exactly. Part, right. So if Georgia was to pass a new voter suppression law in 2022 and the John Lewis law was in effect, the Justice Department or the federal courts could block it. However, they wouldn't do anything about all the laws that have already passed. 14 states have already enacted new restrictions on voting, and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act would not retroactively overturn those things. And that's why the For the People Act is so important, because it puts in place policies like automatic and election day registration, 2 weeks of early voting, no excuse absentee voting, that would override for federal elections these state voter suppression laws. And it would apply equally to all 50 states. So there's no question about some states being treated differently than others, which is one of the qualms that the Supreme Court had about the Voting Rights Act, and would still potentially be an issue in a new VRA. And so I think that if you talk to people in the voting rights space, they say these two bills were drafted together. Mm-hmm. They're meant to accompany each other. The For the People Act puts in place a lot of the pro-voter policies, and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act gives the federal government a tool to block voter suppression before it occurs. But if you have one without the other, you're still leaving a lot of room for folks to disenfranchise voters. And so that's the issue with just supporting the John Lewis VRA.
Not the other, right.
But is also to say the bigger issue is that there's no path to actually passing it. I mean, I think at the end of the day, if you said to people, we can get a new Voting Rights Act passed and we have 60 votes, but we can't get the For the People Act passed, people would be upset about it, but they would be okay with passing a new Voting Rights Act. The problem is there's not a path forward to either of them without getting rid of the filibuster. And Manchin hasn't signaled any openness to doing this. So now it seems like both of them are doomed, which is the worst case scenario.
It's unbelievable. And Manchin, every time he's asked, he seems to double down even more. For instance, this was just the other day.
Would you be willing to break the filibuster in order to get this passed? The plan B is
I'm not ready to destroy our government.
I'm not ready to destroy our government is what's his answer. And my response to that was, but he'll stand by and let the Republicans destroy our government. In my book, that makes him complicit, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, the point is that Republicans have showed their hand. And the question is, what are Democrats going to do about it? And if Democrats don't do anything to stop the greatest rollback of voting rights since Reconstruction, they are complicit for allowing it to happen. Just like at the end of Reconstruction, when Republicans, who were at the time the Party of Civil Rights, failed to stop Democratic efforts to institute Jim Crow, they were complicit in the disenfranchisement too, because they could have stopped it and they chose not to. And that's the really important thing here. They have the power to do this. They can eliminate or use exceptions to the filibuster with a majority vote. So they have the numbers in the Senate to change the filibuster rule. They're just unwilling to do it. And it's just incredible that an obscure Senate rule that for so long has been used to maintain Jim Crow-like policies is taking precedence over stopping the next wave of Jim Crow laws. I mean, I don't understand any universe in which protecting the filibuster is more important than protecting the right to vote. But that's where we are right now, not just with Joe Manchin, but with Kyrsten Sinema and potentially a few other senators as well.
You know, and Kyrsten Sinema, both of them, they're saying something like, well, it was the founders, but the filibuster had nothing to do with the founders. The filibuster is not in the Constitution. It was not the founders. It came about many years later for different purposes, and in no way fosters bipartisanship. I mean, you listen to Kyrsten Sinema, I have this thing about opposite world, and she seems to be firmly entrenched there because she's got it backwards.
Well, yeah, and the filibuster doesn't even lead to bipartisanship. I mean, look at the January 6th vote. Mm-hmm. You had 54 GOP and Democratic senators support a bill, and it was blocked by 35 Republican senators. So in fact, it was the partisans who beat the bipartisan team when it came to the filibuster. If it hadn't been for the filibuster, you would have had a very bipartisan piece of legislation pass quite easily. And so if anything, the filibuster allows one party and a small minority of a party to block things that are supported by huge majorities of Americans. I mean, it's always frustrating when people quote the founders, because first off, the founders didn't want black people, a lot of other people.
That's right. That's right.
But secondly, Madison's conception of the Senate was a place to cool off legislation, not to kill it entirely. I don't think Madison would have liked a situation where 80 to 90% of the public support things like gun control or voting rights or climate change legislation, and it's killed by a small minority of senators. I don't believe that was the vision that even the founders, with all their flaws, had for the Senate. So the filibuster is really a perversion of the Senate, and the idea that the filibuster forms the core of the Senate, to me, that just shows how broken the Senate is right now.
Right. And for them to hold it up and say, this is, you know, the marker on which we're going to lay our swords. It's not, I keep pulling out the card. It's not in the Constitution. It does not, it's not there. It was never supposed to be a super majority for anything except impeachment, if I read this thing correctly. And so they're just misinformed. Ari Berman, a little while ago on Twitter, you tweeted, I cannot get over the fact that Joe Manchin says voting rights legislation must have, quote, bipartisan supermajority when Republicans brazenly changing the rules in the states to prevent Dems from ever winning another fair election. Total unilateral disarmament. It's spot on. And so brings me back to, what can we do? I mean, you got Manchin and Sinema, and we're not sure that nobody else would, you know, gunk up the works, but I think most of them would be led. Look, Chris Coons, I worry about, but I think he'll do whatever Joe Biden tells him to do. I wish there was some way we can have an intervention with, you know, I was just listening again to Raphael Warnock's maiden speech, some of it on the floor of the Senate, which happened right before they passed these laws. And he's just so passionate and spot on in everything he says. And it makes me wonder why Joe Manchin is so dug in here and why Joe Biden doesn't channel his inner LBJ and make him do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, LBJ had a huge Democratic majority to deal with, whereas Biden has 50 senators, and he said two of them who don't often vote with him. I do think that everyone needs to get a lot more aggressive here. I think the White House needs to get more aggressive in making the Democratic senators fall in line. And I think that a lot more pressure needs to be brought to bear on these holdouts. I think that they've been treated with kid gloves, Manchin and Sinema, so far. And I think that there needs to be more pressure both within the caucus, and I think there needs to be more pressure outside of the caucus. I mean, it's not like we're asking them to support this radical piece of legislation. These are pieces of legislation that are supported by 70% of Americans that have policies that are very, very popular. I mean, Manchin can't even point to any substantive issues with the For the People Act. It's all based on policies that have already worked well in the states. And it's policies that in many cases have worked well in Republican states. Georgia has automatic voter registration. Utah has universal vote by mail. Texas has 2 weeks of early voting. I mean, these are all things that are in the For the People Act. I mean, so it basically took the things that were working well in the states when it comes to voting and just put them all in one place. So there's nothing radical about these policies. And the bill is very popular because of it. And in fact, you had, you know, the Koch brothers and their networks complaining behind closed doors that the bill is too popular. And the only reason that it's dying in Washington is because it's been demonized so effectively by the right wing and by the conservative movement. And that's who Manchin is responding to. And the question is, why does he care more about the Chamber of Commerce or the Heritage Foundation or Mitch McConnell than he does the people that helped elect him and the majority that he claims to represent? And so I think that people have to be more aggressive in terms of fighting for this. And I also think it needs to be posed more as a civil rights issue, that we are facing the greatest rollback of voting rights since the end of Reconstruction. Yep. And the question is Senator Manchin going to be the person that allows it to happen? Because right now the ball is really in his court.
It is.
And it's just a total cop-out to say, I don't support one thing when the other party is doing far worse and making false equivalents between it. But also I support another thing, but I'm not willing to actually do anything to get it passed.
Exactly.
That's just a total abdication of his responsibility.
Without a doubt. There's one other thing that really bugs me, and maybe you have some insight into this because I can't figure it out. Whenever some Republican is on television doing an interview, talking about why these laws are necessary, they always bring up voter ID. Why do they have a problem with voter ID? Anytime you do anything, you need to show ID. And I scream at the television, it's not a problem with asking for ID. It's the restrictions on what ID you can use. If you live in Texas and you go to a state university, you can't use your college ID, but hey, you can use your gun license. It has to be reasonable. It has to be, an ID that shows you who you say you are. But they have these ridiculous restrictions on them, which puts mostly, you know, people of color, older people, people of limited means at a disadvantage into getting those specific documents. It's not a question of having a problem with voter ID. It's the restrictions on the voter ID.
That's right. It's the devil's in the details in terms of who does and doesn't have ID and how the laws are written. I would also say a lot of the ID laws make no sense. For example, the whole point of in-person ID is to be able to verify your identity. Well, applying it to mail ballots makes no sense because nobody's checking your ID when you vote by mail anyway. So your signature makes a lot more sense. And the thing is, these laws go so far beyond voter ID. We're so far past preventing election officials from sending out mail ballot request forms. That has nothing to do with voter ID.
Nothing.
Cutting Sunday voting, nothing to do with voter ID. Making it easier to overturn elections, nothing to do with voter ID. So like they've picked the one policy that they feel is popular, and they're ignoring all the other things they're doing that has nothing to do with voter ID or election integrity for that matter, that is very unpopular. So they want to make this about kind of one narrow issue as opposed to the 20 different ways they're trying to roll back voting access.
Ari Berman, you do such a great job covering this. I'm grateful for your reporting every day. Of course, your book, Give Us the Ballot, is already, it's got to be 5 years old already, isn't it? You have a new one coming, don't you?
Eventually, eventually. Still writing this one.
Okay, well, you're in the middle of it. You haven't had a free moment. So, exactly. Did you ever imagine when that book came out that today we'd be in this boat?
Well, I had hoped we wouldn't be, but you always write books and hope they'll remain relevant. So I guess I have had great cost of democracy. My book has remained quite relevant.
Yes, it has. Well, hopefully the new one can have a happier ending, but we got to do something about that mansion problem before that can happen. Ari Berman, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. You know, I'm always asking you, and I understand how busy you are. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Nicole. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. Ari Berman, he's one of the treasures we have. And I thank goodness for his work every day. All right, with that, we're done for the day. We'll be back tomorrow with a doubleheader. Cory Doctorow, if you don't know who he is, look him up. I'm a little intimidated because he's coming on live. And, of course, Howie Klein. So it's a doubleheader Thursday. All right, thanks for listening. Have a good one, everyone. And let's protect our right to vote. And let's get rid of Merrick Garland.